Hello and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a delight to welcome Radio 6 music broadcaster, Sean Keaveney.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm all right. It's the morning, isn't it?
It's very early.
Woke up, got out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. It doesn't look like it.
It looks great. I wish I looked that good in the morning.
Charmer.
As you know, the format of the show, we talk about albums. But first of all, when did the Beatles first come into your world? Did you have a lot of music around you as a kid?
The funny thing is, and a lot of people say this, but I actually looked this up. I think I've got a condition, which means that I've got so few memories of any. They're so vague, my memories, it's ridiculous. I think I need a brain operation, which I'm not going to get. But what's interesting, I've got quite vivid memories of the Beatles, of being sort of around what must have been about 5 or 6, because we have a big family, a big northern family. And as kids, me and my brother used to spend a lot of time with my grandparents because my mum and dad worked in Ierfold in Lee. And I know. And my grandparents had 5 kids, including my mum, obviously. And their youngest, stick with it, it's worth it. where's he going with this? Martin, was he in the Beatles? No, he wasn't. Their youngest, my youngest uncle, Martin, was like 2 years older than me. So he was like a big brother, you know.
Yeah.
And his brother, my Uncle Paul, was mad into music. So there were loads of albums in their house. But very specifically, when we were little, we really focused in on the Red and the Blue Beatles compilations, you know, those classic original Beatles compilations. And I think he also had, a bit later on, the Beatles Love Songs one, you know, that lovely sort of brown, what looks like leather, you know. And that was it. That's what I really remember, is being in the front room of my gran's house with our aunts, just constantly listening to specifically those albums, actually. And so that was the formative Beatle experience.
Because I remember you saying, when I first approached you, you were saying Sgt. Pepper, which is the album we're talking about today, that you've changed your mind about it. So is that for the better or for the worse?
Much for the better, because, I think I explained to you at the time that I've been on a weird journey with that record, because for all my listening life up until, I would honestly say, 3 years ago, I've always disregarded it. Isn't that ridiculous? No, not completely disregarded it. I understood intellectually the importance of it, and watched all the documentaries and read all the op-eds about how unbelievably seismic culturally it was. So I knew that, but it didn't get under my ribs at all. I was very indifferent about it musically. I thought it was twee. I thought it was, it had some of the, I still think some of the songs are crap. I don't know how much I can, you have to bleep me out in places. I still think some of them are weak, but then there was this complete volte face on it. And I've got a specific memory. I borrowed this really posh car about 3 years ago when it was 2017. So it was the 50th anniversary. And I was driving the kids from my mum and dad's back down south in this dead posh car that I had to give back later on that day, sadly. And, great stereo. And for some reason, I just thought, oh, Spotify. It popped up on my Spotify, you know, the 50th anniversary edition of Sgt. Pepper. This is a good time to listen to the whole album. The kids are quiet in the back, and they're like the Beatles anyway. And so I put it on. And I don't know why. I don't know what it was about that moment, but it was like, it made me think, the Beatles are a security blanket emotionally for me all through my life. So whether something was going on at that moment and I needed them, I needed John, Paul, George and Ringo, but it was a salve. It just made me feel amazing. And then from there, I sort of started to click back into it. you know, started to rediscover it, really.
Yeah, I think Giles Martin's remix really opened it up for a lot of people, because you think back in the 90s, Blur and Oasis and the NME Melody Maker, Revolver was the one, and that was kind of like the generation after the 70s, and everyone was saying Pepper's the best album. And it was like, no, we know better. We've got this relatively obscure electric guitar Oasis-y Britpop band doing Revolver. And Pepper was sort of pushed, for me, I just feel it was pushed further and further back in people's opinions, and over familiarity as well, I guess. But I think Giles Martin's remix is really, there's some songs here that just blow your head off.
Yeah, I don't doubt it that... I mean, it's ridiculous, Chris, because I do a radio show on Six Music, and
yeah,
my listeners are so sick of me saying this stuff, because I do it as a joke, really, but it's not really a joke. You know, I am a failed musician. I've got, the house is full of guitars and drum kits and everything. And I think I'm all right. You know, I'm not going to be, falsely modest. I actually think, oh, you know, you're not a bad musician, you know. Yeah, you've got a good ear. But that, all that said, I'm still massively cloth-eared when it comes to stuff like, well, it's like one of my other favorites, you know, the old Zeppelins. Jimmy Page comes back and goes, well, I've completely remastered Led Zeppelin 3, and you can really hear the bass tones. And I'm like, I'm sorry, mate, you've lost me, because I can't really tell the difference. I just like it.
Yeah.
You know, but I do know that there's something about this. I've got a nice record player, and there's something about those 108 RAM. You put it on, and it's like, it just makes you feel good. But you know, it's something better going on. I don't know what it is.
Start with the first track. Instantly, aside from the cover, which we can talk about later, but immediately we're in rock and Victoriana crossover with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Absolutely. This is it, isn't it? Another thing to declare right at the beginning is that during the first lockdown, my old compatriot, Warhorse, Matt Everett, ex-drummer of Menswear, Beatles obsessive, and I think he's done this podcast.
He has.
He lent me Revolution in the Head a year or two ago, actually. And I finally couldn't get with any... Sorry, I'm going really around the houses to answer your question. I couldn't get with any fiction at all in lockdown. And so I started reading it and just blew my head off. It was just great to be... I felt like I was in Carnaby Street. I was on Abbey Road in 1963 to 1970. It was like I'd transported myself away from the coronavirus completely. I was with John Paul, George and Ringo. It was amazing. And so a lot of my memories and thoughts about this record will be from Ian McDonald's brain. But I love that whole story, you know, that whole idea that that sort of junk shop military... Kitchener, sort of early, late Victorian, early 20th century stuff was coming back into fashion a little bit in the swinging 60s. And you saw Hendrix wearing all that garb as well, and people like that. And of course, then once the Beatles and Hendrix did it, everybody else did it. But it obviously, again, they're just creating a zeitgeist. And it all comes from Paul, though, doesn't it? You know? At the beginning. Oh, yeah. Paul.
I was waiting for that.
Yeah, it didn't take long, did it?
No.
But I love, you know, that all this stuff as well, that you... It's Paul who's always the slave driver. Paul's always the one who's cracking the whip. Paul's always the one who's going, come on, guys, you know, let's get going. And Georgie's off making exotic teas with his legs crossed. And Ringo's just pissing about making baked beans on toast. And John's on heroin or something, you know, doing something really dark and weird. But it all pulls the wellspring, but it's everybody else that starts sticking their oar in that makes it magic. But yeah, he was the one who came up with that original concept, wasn't he? This sort of bandstand band and I think it was Neil Aspinall that thought, let's stretch it out to a concept, and it's not really a concept album. But that was the thing that put me off it originally, was that all the kitsch, all the suits, you know, the fact that it's bookended and it's a weak concept album. And eventually, 47 years on, it was all that detail that brought me back to it. Clever bastards.
They are the ultimate sitcom family, the way you've described them there. That's almost like the young ones.
Yeah.
Doing this, a lot of people have been really enjoying albums like Yellow Submarine and the film Yellow Submarine and Sergeant Pepper. And I'm wondering what you're saying as well, is that escapism? You know, you just look at the news and it's a dream world, isn't it, that you can just escape to for a few 40 minutes or whatever.
For me, the Beatles world, like I said before, it was like I've been doing it in other ways as well, I suppose, but yeah, escaping to the 60s, escaping to, and of course you it's ridiculous in a way because you're escaping to what is in many ways a much harsher time, a worse time, you know, in backward time in a lot of ways, but we're not remembering all that. We're just remembering the soft, the broad brush strokes. But yeah, that Sergeant Pepper world is so escapist, and it's so much what everybody needs right now, isn't it? To just get away from this horror that we're currently living through.
Track two, With a Little Help from My Friends.
Well, I'm going to... I apologise for doing this, Chris, because I'm going to continually ride roughshod over the questions and forget to answer them and then go back and answer one and then start answering a second one, so which is what I'm about to do.
Okay.
And quickly say as an addendum that my favourite memory about Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, I've got two actually, about the opening track. First one is... I'm a massive Hendrix fan, and I love that story about the Beatles revealing the album at something like the Savile Theatre or something. I can't remember where it was. And there was a playback, wasn't there? And Hendrix went and was like, hey, man, this is the most amazing record I've ever heard, you know, and all that stuff. And then the next day he was playing somewhere in London, and he did his, like, ridiculous rock version of it.
Yeah,
I love that. I mean... If you know, the Beatles and Jimmy milling around smoking reefer and swapping girlfriends, probably, or whatever the hell they did then. And then just, that's just such a great story. And then weirdly, it's such a great rock track as well. It's 2 minutes long. And I'm going to say something controversial here. I don't think the Beatles rock very well. I just don't think they do. I think that's another thing I've nicked from Ian McDonald, and I agree with him. I still love the rock tracks, like Revolution. Amazing. Sergeant Pepper, brilliant. And the guitar always sounds great, but I just don't think Ringo can drum like a rock. You know, it's like, brum, 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 which is what makes it great, but it's also, it doesn't rock. It's just such a weird position. It's like with any other band, you go, you're gonna have to do another take because that's really lumpen. But because it's them, it works. It's mad. And then my other weird memory is 20 years later, I was up Scarfell Pike with a bunch of other 15-year-olds and my geography teacher, Mr. Mitchell, and he started singing, "It was 20 years ago today." Sergeant Pepper told his band to play. And we were all like, and well, and he's like, it was released 20 years ago today, the Sergeant Pepper album. We were all like, oh, cool, yeah.
Yeah.
But that was, 33 years ago. Ridiculous. Oh, no. So I had to mention that. But you'll have to cut all that out. But then, yeah, Seguin from that rock fabulousness, bad rock, but good rock, into little help from my friends and Ringo. That's another song that for a generation or something, I just totally disregarded. I just thought anything that Ringo sings on is crap. I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Octopus's Garden, cough, mate. You know, all that business. Yellow Submarine, what a load of bollocks. I would categorize with a little help from my friends in there until, again, very recently. It's like archaeology, isn't it? You go, what the hell is that? Oh, it's a gem, you know. And it's obviously just such a classic Paul with that audacious bass line. It's just so, it's literally like you're four and you're being swooped up in a fluffy towel after you've been in the bath by your dad, you know, or your mum. You're just held. And it's that's the greatest sentiment of any song of all time. It's just incredible.
It's perfect for Ringo as well. And again, it's the band backing Ringo. It's that family sitcom family together, you know, it's the kids having it. Come on, kid, you'll go. Mum and dad will be here.
Yeah, it is. That's it. It's like I love reading that stuff about John later on, and it was always John who had the big connection with Ringo, and it was like, I just want to look after him, you know. I've written a couple of songs for his new album. And I love that. They never stopped caring about each other. And that's the other thing that you need now. You need to hear these stories. Even though the top line is they all fell out and it was terrible, that was never really what happened, was it? You know, they all loved each other like brothers. And that song encapsulates that. Like you say, it's like Paul's written one of the best songs he's ever going to write. Don't even want to sing it. Let Ringo sing it. He could have done it better, but it wouldn't have been as good.
Yeah. There's a lovely story. Well, it's not in the context of things, it's not lovely. But on the day John Lennon died, Richard Skinner phoned Annie Nightingale asking if she had Paul McCartney's phone number. And it was him that spoke to Paul to tell him. He, according to Richard Skinner, Paul was saying, shit, we were going to meet up in January. We were going to record some songs together. And that would have been a Ringo's album. They would have been back together for that.
Oh, my God. It's just so sad, isn't it? You know, what could have been. Could have, would have, should have.
One thing as well I've noticed on the end, you know, the very ending, the they are the exact same chords as I may not always love you.
Oh, is it really? God only knows.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's never occurred to me before. Because that, of course, that was the big rivalry, wasn't it? Especially in Paul's head, I think. The whole Brian Wilson thing, he could tell. I mean, they were both bass players and composers, and they were cut from the same cloth, weren't they? And trying to do the same thing, really, at that moment.
Yeah.
So, do you think that was a nod to Brighton then?
I think so. I think it was because there's stories of Paul turning up for the Smile sessions and.
Oh, yeah,
that's great. You know, let me just play you She's Leaving Home, Brian. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's good, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you got, like, Back in the USSR, which is, like, a more direct, almost like a piss take of the early Beach Boys, isn't it?
Yeah. See, I think this might be a homage to Brian, just that little segment there, but I think Back in the USSR is taking the piss out of Mike Love.
Yeah, yeah. I met Mike Love. I interviewed Mike Love when Bruce Johnston once.
Oh, what was that like?
Well, they were perfectly nice, but that was before they came out for Trump hard and fast. You know, I don't think I realised that. I would have known, obviously. But you get an opportunity to speak to the guy you went, I'm thinking about the good vibrations, and you go, I'll take it.
Yeah.
So it was still amazing to. It's like sitting on Guernica's lap or something, isn't it? I don't know. It's just like these people have hewn popular culture, haven't they?
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Moving on to track three, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Love this. Now, here's a funny thing. So somebody, I think it was on Twitter, actually. I think when I was going through Revolution in the Head and just every so often I'd crack a tweet out saying, it's blowing my head off this book, you know. And then somebody made the point, Ian MacDonald has ruined more Beatles songs for me than anybody else in history. And I was like, nah, don't be daft. He's just shining a light. So I find it really fascinating. But I'd have to admit, in this instance, he has ruined Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds a little bit for me, because something stuck that he said about it, if I remember rightly. Because Because Strawberry Fields Forever was released from the same sessions as a single, wasn't it? Was it a double A-side with Penny Lane?
That's it, yeah. It was going to be on the album, but they needed a single. So that was the first few sessions, yeah.
That's it. And on reflection, Strawberry Fields Forever is without doubt one of my favourite songs of all time. Just unbelievably brilliant. And when you read about that song, it's just mad, isn't it? It's just magic, like how they connect up two different versions of it, two different tapes, and it slightly varies speeds in the middle, and then the cellos come in, and then it goes, duh, and it just sounds fucking unbelievable. Like, even thinking about it makes me go weird. And so in comparison to that, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, I've always loved it. I've always looked forward to it coming up on the record. But Ian MacDonald's ruined it a bit, because he says something really dismissive about it. Like, they got, yeah, I mean, you know, it's fantastically produced and George Martin sweated bullets to do it. But it then comes the chorus, and it's just this kind of, it's relatively straightforward 4-4, just one simple vocal line. And I can't get that out of my head now, Chris. It's like he has ruined it a bit. It's Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Yeah, it was like, yeah, it's a bit of a disappointment in comparison to Strawberry Fields. So he's ruined it a little bit for me, though. Yeah. But I still, you know, obviously it's still all that it is. I still can't work out, even though it doesn't matter, if John was being disingenuous when he said, of course, it's not about LSD. You know, Julian drew it, and that's why it's called that. You know, it feels a bit like a really heavy nod to LSD to me, like they've done it deliberately. But and he didn't want to say that because they'd already been in so much trouble about all the things they'd said. What do you think? Do you think that?
I think based on, because Annie Nightingale was on this before, and she was really close, and she was saying, John said over and over again, it's not. It really isn't. He had no reason to lie.
Yeah.
You know, because he trusted her. So I'm with Annie.
Yeah. Okay. I'm always with Annie. So yeah, it really bloody doesn't matter, does it? But it is beautiful and brilliant.
See what you were saying about that chorus, I would say is its strength. Because obviously it's inspired by Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. And you think what other bands were doing at the time, experimenting with psychedelia. So the verse is, you know, pure sort of Pink Floyd level psychedelia, Sid Barrett level. And most people would have just got weirder and weirder. But they've gone back to the sort of northern working class. It's like kids in a playground. Lucy in the Sky. Yeah. It doesn't go where you would expect it after. And it's a real boom, boom. It's like, well, wake up. We're kids playing in school. I love it. Ignore Ian MacDonald.
Ignore him. You're right. Come back to the light. Because that is, you're right. That's the thing that you know, that sort of music hall, Lewis Carroll, mixing all these things in together. And as they say, and obviously people like the Libertines afterwards and a lot of Britpop tried to, and Blur really fixated on the Britishness of it. And then it all went a bit wrong and a bit cartoony. But when they did it, they just hit a beautiful sweet spot, didn't they? It was so... Because, you know, it was 1967. Music hall wasn't all that far in the past then. It was as far in the past as the Beatles are to us, probably. So it was very much more tangible, probably, than it is to us nearly 100 years down the line. But yeah, I do. You're right. You've given me permission, license again to love that. So thanks for that.
Track four, Getting Better.
Love it. Love this song. But again, didn't love it to begin with. You know, I just, this is one of the many that I dismissed. And funnily enough, I don't know if other people have mentioned this to you or not, but when I was a kid, when I was like a teenager, I was mad into bands like The Wedding Present. And The Wedding Present have done such a phenomenal version of this song. Have you heard it?
I've got on the Sgt. Pepper Knew My Father album.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just David Gedge is a genius of his own kind. And he did just a much faster version, obviously, because that's with the really fast right hand thing that George Dave does, which is like almost like George Formby, you know. Again, that works because it's a bit of a connection up for the Beatles, but that got me back into that song a bit. And they changed the lyric to, I used to be cruel to my brother. I beat him and kept him back from the things that he loved. Because I think that by the 80s, that was a bit of a heavy sentiment, wasn't it? It's like, wow, you went there. You know, you went there. Yeah. And obviously it's a character, but it's still fascinating to me that Paul was he was pretty brave though, because that kind of shit must have been going on in to such a horrible level, and it was almost socially acceptable back then, probably. And they were obviously, that's one of the many things that you love about the Beatles. They were so ahead of the time with everything to do with, you know, anything from civil rights to emancipation to all these things. They were like right on it. So I think that's a really brave lyric, actually. And it's such a cracking song, isn't it? It's just really simple, beautiful, to be a bit technical about it. A gorgeous guitar sound. I'm still not sure, probably a Ricky or something like that. But like, it's beautiful. Just a really beautiful, simple track with the lyrics, just the title. Getting Better. I'm talking to my kids about this, you know, especially in this shitty time, this terrible lockdown. And my eldest is nearly 13 and they're going through a lot of hellish times and they're really down on a lot of things. And it's like trying to teach kids, you've got to be optimistic. You have to, it doesn't matter how bleak things seem, we're still really lucky. And kids don't understand that, you know, really. They need to be taught it. And that's what Paul's doing now. He's just going, well, you know, it's gonna be all right. You know, put one foot in front of the other, it'll get better. I just love that.
Yeah, it's just that one line. It can't get no worse, which was John's.
Yeah,
it's just that is the whole of Lennon and McCartney.
You're exactly right. That's so beautiful. It's the yin and the yang, and he just always puts that little shade on it, doesn't it? Because this is the trope that everybody knows. Once Paul was released from the Beatles, then the unfortunate thing was all that saccharine all that optimism. It was too much for most of us. We were like, that it's gone. You've gone totally frog chorus here, mate. You know, we need a little bit of John's. We need a bit of darkness. You know, we need a bit of George's, you know, spirit. You get just can get back together, guys. Stop pissing about. Lovely.
I think Jeff Emmerich, before they started doing this, John approached him and said, right, obviously they quit touring and the whole concept was going to be a studio recording by this fictitious band. But Jeff was asked by John, we want you to create sounds that no one's ever heard before. And Jeff Emmerich just said, and then they just all looked at me.
Go on then.
Yeah. But I think the next track, Fixing a Hole, which is something we'd not heard before.
Well, this is the part of the album that I struggle with tracks like this one, not so much. I'm fixing a hole where the rain comes in. It is kind of beautiful, isn't it, fixing a hole?
Yeah.
But I find that... And I'm going to repeat myself on at least three of these tracks. That this is the kind of this is the kind of song that put me off. Not as much as being For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, which we're going to get to in a bit. So I'll try and save up some ire for that. But this is the part of the album that really puts me in mind of that classic Simpsons episode where they. I don't know if you've ever seen it. If you haven't, you must seek it out, listener. Where Homer Simpson discovers in the attic a box of records that he recorded as part of a barbershop quartet.
Yeah,
with Seymour Skinner and Apu and all this, they go on the same journey as the Beatles.
Mm.
And this is the point of their career where. A bit like what you were saying there about John turning to Jeff Emmerich and saying, we just want, they're so powerful, aren't they, at this point? They're so all-consuming to everybody in the world. Yeah. That power must be so intoxicating. It's literally like you're an emperor or you've got George Martin and Jeff Emmerich and Abbey Road Studios as long as you want. And you're sonic wizards. You can rub the lamp and the genie will pop out and it's George Martin, and he'll make whatever. He'll go inside your head,
yeah.
And he'll pull out the sound you want. It might take 2 months, but he'll do it. But the problem with that, of course, is that it gets indulgent as well, I think. And so, and of course, they realised that, and that's when they sort of went completely the other way. But like songs like Fixing a Hole, once the harpsichords come out sometimes, I get a little bit like, oh, God. You know, there is a tweeness to some of these tracks, I feel, that, and there's something about that little guitar part. Down, down, be bum, bum, be bum, bum, be bum, bum, be bum, bum, be bum, be bum, be bum, be bum, which makes me want to throw my stereo out the window. So, you know, it's weird, isn't it? I've chosen this record, not necessarily because it's wall to wall my favourite. Because I've had a renaissance with it, and there's so much of it I enjoy, I suppose. But also because of, I guess, what we might talk about as well, which is the social, what it represented culturally, I suppose, is another thing that why you would choose it is something to talk about, because that's really interesting as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
but that riff really pisses me off, Chris.
Yeah. Well, that was used again in "Good Morning, Good Morning" on the brass. Section, but I think again this Victoriana obsession, the use of the harpsichord, but you know the Monkees were doing it, the Yardbirds were doing it. It was
yeah.
I love the sound of '60s harpsichords. I think they're because that was it. It was sort of 66 to 68, and then no one really used them again.
It's like the Mellotron, isn't it? Which you hear a lot as well. Beautiful, sort of weird, watery thing. I love hearing them use that stuff. But yeah, fixing a hole. That's where the saccharine nature of Paul. Yeah, you can almost hear the rest of them go. Look, I'll be in Weybridge or whatever. You know, I've just met this woman. You finish it. It's all a bit like that sometimes with the Beatles.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock as the day begins. Silently closing their bedroom door, leaving the note that she hoped would say more. She goes downstairs to the kitchen, clutching a handkerchief. Quietly turning the back door key. Stepping outside, she is free.
And we move on to track 6, She's Leaving Home.
So there you go. That's the ridiculousness of this record. Without question, one of the greatest pieces of popular music that's ever been written. What else can you say about it? And people much more intelligent and verbose than me will have written poems about it, entire books about it. It's just that I think that, and again, I'm going back to my memory of being in the posh car. It was probably like junction 12 of the M6 at this point, I think, with the kids in the back. They were probably on the screens, so they were leaving me alone.
Yeah.
And this comes on. And every so often when I'm in the car, I put music on that I really love, I will have a cry. Oh. And I have to make sure that the kids don't notice because, you know, obviously they'll be like, what is the matter with you? Mm. And this would have done. You know, without a doubt, because it's the motherlode of parental emotion, isn't it?
It's beautiful. You think as well, Paul at the time was hanging around with Peter Asher, and it's got that kitchen sink dramas at the time.
Yeah.
And there's a story. So interestingly, a while ago on Twitter, I did a poll on this song saying Paul's ability to cross the divide of the generation gap as an example. I think this has got to be one of the first instances, but where do your sympathies lie with A, the daughter, or B, the parents? And it was really close. And it was daughter got 46%, parents 54%.
Yeah, because the ageing population of the Beatles fan, of course, are becoming, a lot of them are grandparents now, aren't they? So
that's
you've hit the nail on the head there. Even when I was a kid, I wasn't a precocious child by any stretch of the imagination, but I could tell that something amazing had happened with the lyric on that. We could do an hour on just the music and we probably have a bit of a go at it. But when it comes to the lyric, it's like, it's so, again, with the Beatles, like a great actor actually, or a fantastic playwright, how they can embody a character and feel that they're empaths, aren't they? They can feel this. You know, Paul has gone, he already knows what it must be like to be a 17-year-old kid who wants to get out because he's done all that, but he's not a parent yet. And he's brought that into existence so beautifully. It's like he's gone forward in time to when his kid's leaving home and he's nailed it. It's like, it's so beautiful. And again, the great, great strength of the Beatles, from what Ian says in his book, I think, is I just love hearing about when they actually co-produce something, when they really co-write. Because I get really sad when it gets to this point in the career and they're doing everything separately. I want them to be together. And they do it a bit on this track, don't they? Like John comes in and George, and they... That counterpoint in the chorus, you know, she's leaving home, and then it's that we gave them all of our lives. You know, I'm going now. That's just so perfect. It's like both voices at exactly the same time. You've got her hope and optimism. She's starting off on a journey, and you've got the mum and dad knowing that part of their life's over, and they're looking at, really, actually, even, I'm reading too much into it now, but they're probably looking at each other over the breakfast table thinking, "Kinel, I don't even like you." You know, and we've been living for her for 18 years, and now she's gone. It's all there. And that's without even getting into the string arrangement, which is like, who was it who did that? It was
Mike Leander.
That's it. If that's the only thing you've done in your career is arrange that track, then you're in the pantheon forever, aren't you? It's just unbelievably brilliant. So the chances of me getting to the end of that song and not crying now at the age of 48 with three kids is zero, you know. But luckily, the youngest is only 1 year old, Chris. So I'll probably be nearly dead by the time she's leaving now.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there. Late of Pablo Frank is there. What a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hogshead of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will challenge the world.
We end side one with being for the benefit of Mr. Kite.
Hate it. Absolutely flipping hate that track. And I do. Again, I go back to the Simpsons episode, which is one of the funniest bits of the Simpsons ever, where they're all sitting round and they've got a version of this, you know, and it's like, because it was, what was it? It was John had bought a poster,
yeah,
of a Victorian fair or something, or it was verbatim, virtually, yeah. That was the lyric, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, from a producer perspective, I will give top marks. But this is John saying to Jeff and to George, "Oh, and then there's an elephant, and then there's a man on his back spinning another man round in a barrel. Can you make that sound?" You know, and all that. Yeah. And they do it, and they crack it, and so 10 out of 10 is a technical exercise. It's utter emotional vapidity drives me mad. It's like, it feels like to me, John, this is John taking a break from his brain. You know, this is John taking a break from his very deep feelings about everything, because he is a massive empath and he's destroying his marriage. You know, he doesn't see his kid much. He's the biggest star in the world. He's probably on a mind-altering amount of drugs. He's completely lost. And this is his safe harbour, is to go into some kind of psychedelic cul-de-sac that must be like a duvet coming over him. "I don't want to do, I found out, and, you know, the Plastic Ono Band stuff is 3 years away, you know. The Janoff screen therapy, that's all coming."
Yeah.
This is before, and but as a listen, I find it extremely difficult. Do you like it?
I'm very biased. I love it. I love it. I love the whole dreamscape thing. It's just pure psychedelic. Again, I love British psychedelia over US psychedelia, because it was much less dark. It was less political. Yeah. And it was less political. And this was purely, as you said, it's almost verbatim from a poster. And he was so lazy. It was astonishing. All he was doing was reading. There's all those photos of him from end of 66 with all of these books. And that's all he was doing. He was sleeping, reading. That was it, really. And it's bound to come out. And so many of the songs in here are inspired by newspaper articles and adverts. Yeah. And so he wasn't doing... He was in his own lockdown, I guess. And that's where he went.
Yeah. That's it, isn't it? Actually, just to mention as a side order, you think that it's a very 2020 thing to, you know, I really worry about kids and the kids these days, and worry about social media, and worry about how everybody's exposed to trolls and the nastiness in public life. And think of it as a very 2020 thing. And it's not, because people like the Beatles in the 60s must have had it a million times worse than anybody else, because it was, they couldn't go anywhere. They couldn't say anything. They couldn't be with anybody. They couldn't exist without a million people having an opinion on it and dragging them down for it. They'd had all the experiences, like the thing in the Philippines where they nearly died. They had the experiences of, you know, we're bigger than Jesus, and people, I mean, we can see the madness of America now, but it was civil rights was just kicking off, wasn't it? So they were exposed to all this, and they had no protection whatsoever. It's not like the managers knew how to help them or anything. So I can just only imagine how mentally ill it must have made them. And I'm not saying, you know, they're heroes and should be protected, you know. But yeah, I am in a way saying that. It's like, you can give people all the money in the world, but it's that brilliant George Harrison quote, isn't it? From that people gave us their money and their ticket receipts, but we gave our nervous systems. You know, it's like...
Very good.
Exactly right. So no wonder John disappeared into his conservatory and just barricaded himself off, you know. And so, yeah, again, what's nice about this is that I'll probably revisit with a bit more kindness that track.
Yeah, hope so. So flip over to side two, George's only song on the album, Within You, Without You.
I really like Within You, Without You. Did not for years, you know. Didn't get on with it for years. And of course, especially if you're a kind of particular Beatles fan who's a bit more Alan Partridge about it, you know. The best of the Beatles. Or, you know, like your middle American or you might be a middle-aged mum in the 60s or 70s and you really like She Loves You, and that's great. You know, that was the beauty of the Beatles. They appealed across the ages, across all races, all barriers. But George's stuff was a bit outre for most people, wasn't it? It was a bit like, we'll just fast forward this one because it's a little bit... Mm-hmm. You know, you can imagine it in the 60s, can't you, in England. It must have been like, well, it's a bit chicken curry, isn't it? You know, I don't think we're going to bother with that. You know, you can imagine somebody doing that. But this is it. He was, and as it, again, Ian McDonald talks about, there are certain points in the career that he goes off. I love it in that book how he can do half a page on a song that you think's incredibly important.
Yeah.
It's like guitar, bass, drums, recorded on this date, perfunctory lyric, don't think much of it. You're like, what the fuck? That was She Loves You or whatever, you know. Yeah. But then he goes, he'll do 12 pages on some, like Tomorrow Never Knows, and talking about how nobody in Western music had used drones since the 12th century or something, you know. And then here come the Beatles doing it. They completely blew everybody's mind. And he credits George with that whole thing of bringing the whole of Eastern culture and mysticism into the center of Western culture. But then I love how he kind of throws him under the bus as well. He sort of goes, yeah, he did that, but thanks to fucking George, we've also got all this hippy dippy bollocks. You know, we've also got, and the other thing I find fascinating, and this is the basis of it, this song even, this kind of song, is how the Beatles were all very obtuse about we're leaving the old establishment behind. It's all about you. It's what you think. Your personal opinion, your viewpoint is as valid as facts. It's as valid as science, you know, how you feel. And it's like when you read that as a sort of sociological treatise, you think you can see how damaging it was as well as how liberating it was.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. But to get back to this song, you know, do you need to come in here, love? Do
yeah,
I need
sorry,
to move?
I've been waiting for ages.
I hope you keep this in the podcast, Chris, because okay. I'm being my wife
no,
now.
You don't have to.
You know what? Vinette doesn't like the Beatles.
What?
Thinks shit.
I wouldn't go that far.
She's a ridiculous. I mean, we're actually married, which is. I don't really know. It's happened sometimes.
Did you not have a prenup?
Yeah. It's because I'm basically a different generation.
You make me sound like a cradle snatcher. You're 9 years younger than me. Bloody hell. Ridiculous. But that's it. So this track is all that opens up to me when I think about it now. All that sociological stuff. But as a song, again, I love it. I just love the studiousness of George. I love how he got the piss taken out of him for so much for that. But he was absolutely locked on from the beginning, wasn't he? Like, as soon as to 64, 65, whatever, he's a kid. He's like 21 or something, 22 at this point. And he's gone, no, it ain't for me, this. This is not the real world, this. This adulation. Not interested. You know, he could have gone on a massive drugs odyssey. He could have got completely top. He could have... And obviously they did a bit of all that. But he very soon checked that at the door and was like, I'm going to go inwards. I'm going to find the truth here, you know. And whatever you think about... I mean, I wouldn't say I'm a Buddhist, but there's so many things that he says that resonate, you know, make me think, yeah, mate, you know, you're closer to the answer than Nigel fucking Farage is, for instance. You know what I mean? I'd rather follow you and be a bit like, oh, I'm not sure about that bit, but
yeah.
He's so old heart, George, isn't he? And that life goes on within you and without you is just like for a 24-year-old kid to say that so beautifully. I just think it's incredible, really.
It's interesting. I mean, it's a whole episode, really, is faith, but I mean, he had a reasonably traditional Catholic upbringing as a kid, and obviously that passion for a deity was there, and he took it in this direction. And in this, he quotes a couple of the Gospels from St. Matthew and St. Mark, those who gain the world and lose their soul, in a very kind of finger-pointery way.
Yeah.
So, his need for faith was there in whatever direction he took this one, I guess.
Yeah, that's it. He's, you know, he can be quite didactic at times, I think is the word, but it's the 60s. Nobody's ever done anything like this before. That's what I think is amazing. It's like, before that song, what's the most sophisticated lyric that you can think of? You know, like Bacharach and David, it's like, I've met a girl, she's great, she's the greatest girl. I want to go to San Jose because there's some girls there, you know, or whatever. It's great. Obviously, it's what is the lifeblood of our existence, this music. But these guys are going, they're just taking it somewhere to a different part of the universe. And I don't think, sometimes I just think they do get enough credit for it, obviously, but they deserve it.
I'd be out till 2:45. Would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
So in stark contrast, we now move from India to Northern working class Liverpool when I'm 64.
Do, 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 do. Hated it for so many years. You know. Hated that song. And what I find remarkable about it is, again, reading the Bible about it, was that it was something that Paul had from being a teenager, didn't he, I think?
Yeah.
It was one of those. It was like George Michael writing Careless Whisper on a bus in Watford when he was 16 or something. It's the arguably even bigger than that. But that, again, showing his empath skills, being whatever he must have been, 15 or 16, and knocking that lyric out. I mean, I'm sure he finessed it, but
yeah.
Who thinks about when you're 64, when you're 16? It's just ridiculous, isn't it?
I think because John was saying that he loved going around Paul's house as a kid. He couldn't get his head around it. It was this big old family, traditional family, and they would all get together around the piano, do all the sing songs. It was just so alien to him. And that background, I think, is the result. You know, this is what is bound to come out of that, isn't it? I just love the idea of him as a kid. And you can imagine all the Dad, you know, come and listen to this, you know.
Oh, love it. God, he must have been dying of pride, you know. I mean, losing the mums like that, the boys. And because he was older, Paul's dad, wasn't he? He was quite a bit of an older dad, have I got that right?
Yeah.
Bit like me, a bit of an older dad. So, God, you imagine what a crumbly bastard my kids think I am. You know, like, he's literally like, I think about this though, Chris. I think, like, my youngest is one, so the music that I love is some of this is nearly 60 years old. So when she's 30, or when she's my age, it's going to be over 100 years ago when this stuff came out. So it's like, what's 100 years? I mean, it's like listening to Brahms or something, you know. It's just ridiculously old, isn't it? I just had a moment there where I realised that, partially because of the title of the song. But yeah, whatever's going on the arrangement, is it some oboe or something? I don't know. What's the
clarinets? Bass clarinets.
Yeah. So again, didn't like it for years, partially because it's like, it's wallpaper, isn't it? That song and that sentiment is of the ages. It's as old as the hills. As a kid, why would you be interested in it? Especially all the way up to being in your late 30s, you think, well, that's not for me. That's for old people. F off and die. I'm living my life. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm old.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be older too. What a beautiful, beautiful song about growing old together, about the importance of family. And in this day, you know, the way things are at the minute, it's just no wonder people crave this stuff, because all that, it's all under threat, really, in a sense, isn't it? You know, existential threat. We're all, everybody is. Older people are. Mm-hmm. So it's just like the great art is stuff that gets stronger with age, isn't it? I suppose. This is one of them, really.
Again, as you say, he was so young to write those lyrics. He's sort of looking through his father's eyes almost. And his ability to jump into different characters just astounds me. I'm sure the lyrics may have been, you know, altered a bit as he got a bit older, but I think it's lyrically astonishing for someone so young. Yeah, and it really touches me, especially I think it's the whole situation we're in as well. Yeah, I find it incredibly moving in a strange way, out of all of the songs. Bizarre.
No, I do for that. I suppose that's the thing. It reminds me of my family, who I can't currently see, for instance. You know, I can't easily just, like we usually do, pop in the car and go and visit mum and dad and see all the folks and have that. We could have that experience on tap before the virus, actually, more or less, notwithstanding our busy lives. Should we pop up and see the folks this weekend? And you could be in that for a little while. So the access to it made it, you could take it for granted, but the way things are in this crappy year, it makes it all the more moving, that song. And you know, just those little inflections that the Beatles do. Vera, Chuck, and Dave. Like, wow. I just love how fucking unbelievably, unapologetically Liverpudlian, Northwestern, British, English they are. I know that, again, everybody said it, but you got to keep saying it, because it's very soon after that period, nearly all British musicians slipped back into that lazy Americana, didn't they? We're all going to sing in an American accent, even though you're from Preston. I don't understand it. And then there was that, 10 years after this, there was that real bitch fest in the NME, I think, between Sting and Elvis Costello. You know, Elvis Costello was said in an interview, Sting singing in his cod Jamaican accent, like a real zinger that was, Elvis. And then Sting was like, well, you sing in a cod American accent. So,
yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you can sing in what accent you want, but it's just so nice to hear you. You don't hear Liverpudlians represented before the 1960s, do you? You know, now they've ruled the world.
Next track, Lovely Rita.
As I've said at the beginning, my Sgt. Pepper listening in the early days was cursory. I probably would have gone first three tracks, maybe the first four tracks, skip a load in the middle, go to A Day in the Life. That was probably how I listened to it.
Yeah.
And then only more recently did I let it run all the way, especially when I was in the luxury car.
Wow.
You know, you've got the heated seats.
Oh.
Everything's easier, isn't
Cruise control?
Cruise control.
Blimey.
Can really dig in. So, which one am I? This is Lovely Rita.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. These are the ones that, these next two are such fun, I think. I just think, and this is when I, especially this and Good Morning, I suppose we'll do them in order, but Lovely Rita's almost traditional in its songwriting style. You know, it's quite guitar-y and quite tough. Nice little gritty, you know, rhythm. But again, there's so much going on with the production.
Oh,
this is a slightly more pole one. Again, this is the thing that I love so much, is how it makes me cry, literally, sometimes, when I think about this lot in a studio together, when it's working. Like, when it's not working, it's painful. And it's like a divorce. It's like your parents are splitting up and you're sitting on the stairs crying. But when it's working, it's like being at a party at your mum and dad's house when everybody's kissing each other and drinking and listening to Motown. And that's what songs like this make me think, even if that wasn't the reality. Like you say, you've got John just puts a little sparkle at the front of it, you know. And like She's Leaving Home, you can imagine John going, what this needs is a bit of a counterpoint on that. Why don't we put the backing vocal being the mum and dad, you know. That's a great idea, John. That's great. Yeah, that's what we'll do. Ring George, we'll do it now. That whole brotherly, fraternal, pass me the guitar, I've got a great idea for your song. It breaks my heart, that. It's just so, it must have been such a grief for them all when it split up. There's so much rancor in it that they didn't, and I've been there, you know, you have a divorce, there's years of background radiation where you're in so much pain with the other person that you don't, you know, then you've got to let all that go. And that's what, they must have had so much pain and they bloody hated each other for different things. But when all that cleared, it was like, oh, we need each other. You know, we love each other. And that, I'm going a bit too deep on that with this song, but I love, that's what this song makes me feel. And just the other thing it makes me feel is, I can just imagine it's 1966 or 67. Paul is wearing a roll neck and a jazzy jacket. He's got his daft tash and he's you know, his 50 quid haircut, which would have been a lot then.
Yeah.
He's literally pootling around the not yet pedestrianised Carnaby Street in his Union Jack Mini, and he's wolf whistling girls, and they're going, "Paul," and he's like clattering about in boutiques, and he's with Jane Asher, I suppose. So him and Jane, they might go for some lovely lunch and take a bit of LSD in the afternoon on the Thames, and I've got the whole picture, you know. Or maybe Jane's out of town, because this all used to happen a lot with the Beatles, didn't it? You know, there were always a lot of free love, yeah. And Paul flirting with a lot of different ladies, maybe down at the Bag of Nails, maybe Hendrix is playing, and he's transporting all that in the joy of that freedom into a song. I love it.
About getting a parking ticket.
About, yeah. He's got a parking ticket, but he's flirting his way out of it. And then there's some, if I'm not remembering this wrong, there's some slight allusion to a threesome in there, I'm sure. But
oh, sister or two.
That made me raise my eyebrows a bit. Like, bloody hell. Well, I'm sure it all went on in the 60s, you know. But there's an unbridled joy to that song, isn't there?
I think you just played a clip before we did this, and it's just his voice is dancing as he's singing this. It's so much fun. Love it.
I love that. Again, that's the dry academia of Ian McDonald. Sorry to keep going on about him. I must read more Beatles books. But I love how he basically brings it, boils it all down to, when you're listening to a Paul song, then the melody moves around a lot. It goes up and down. And it dances, like you say, it dances up, and he's got a very big range. John tends to be much more flat and, you know, riffy and sort of, nay, 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 nay. He stays on one note for a lot longer or whatever, you know. And the more you've got that in mind, the more you think, yeah, you're right there. It's interesting. And that you can hear on Lovely Rita, I think. He's all over the shop.
So we move on to Good Morning, Good Morning.
There's so much going on in this song, isn't there? There's so much going on in this song. I think this song is encapsulates Sergeant Pepper better than any of the other ones in a way, because it's what I always took, was what people say now, which annoys me. The takeaway about Sergeant Pepper that I always had, even when I wasn't that into it, was it really invented, not that it invented psychedelia, because they were a bit influenced by psychedelia, but it cemented it. And it took everybody that listened to it, musicians and producers went, what the fuck have you, have you done that? What are you doing? How have you done it? What am I listening to? Because even now I would say it would be a challenge with all the software in the world to make a record that sounds like that, with all the sound effects, with all the different arrangement inflections in it, with the whatever those, was it tubas or something coming in? Like, it's almost like listening to a Terry Gilliam art piece. Yeah. That's what it feels like. And then in comes, it's a bit like Yellow Submarine as well, you know, like in comes a massive boot or something and splat, you know, Ringo is gone. And of course, the trademark John jumping around the time signatures in such an insane way that he doesn't know. He just plays it, doesn't he? I've got a song. And he's like, and you can just imagine George and Paul with the notepads going 3-4, 5-4, 4-4, 4-4, 8. What's that? 9-8? What's going on here? And he's like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. That reminds me of Happiness is a Warm Gun, one, isn't it? Yeah. Which does that. Which is just, I don't understand what I'm listening to. And I'm sort of, even my friends who are much better musicians than me, who are schooled, it's like, I guess that's the point, because John is not schooled.
Yeah.
It's so instinctive, but his brain is so, he would have been, they would have been Stockhausen or something, wouldn't they? You know, a few years earlier or something, they would have been, if they'd have been sent to a Vienna music school, God knows what they'd have come out with. It wouldn't have been as exciting as what the Beatles came out with, though, I don't think. But this song is just like a fractal. It's like a bath bomb of ideas, isn't it? And what I love about it the most is that there's an irony to that, because one of the main refrains lyrically is, I've got nothing to say, but it's okay. And I think he was struggling a bit at the time, wasn't he, with his art. He was struggling a bit. Yeah. He felt like maybe he was a bit run out at that time.
He was very strung out on acid at the time. And later on, he had that big old chat with Derek Taylor, because he's basically, he was reading Timothy Leary. It's all about get rid of your ego. And that's what he was doing. He was taking astonishing amounts of it. But I think, you know, the fact, again, he would have been at home. For me, it's another lockdown song, because it is day-to-day. It's just eating your breakfast, watching telly, listening to the radio. But with all that acid bubbling away in his brain. And it's just a surreal version of what it's like now, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. So, that's it. Like you say, that whole... they were all doing it. They were all doing it. Hang on to your ego. You know, the famous, let's go for dinner with the dentist. And from that moment on, you can hear the struggle in somebody like John, who is the biggest star in the world, unquestionably, but at the same time doesn't want to be, and does want to be, and doesn't want to be. And it's like Schrodinger's pop star, isn't it? I do and I don't want to be the biggest pop star in the world. I have got no ego. I've got the biggest ego in the entire world.
Yeah.
It must have been an absolute, must have melted his mind, really.
Yeah.
But I do love that record. And it's a good melody as well. It's a good song. So you can listen to it just on that superficial level, but you can spend, I mean, you could probably write a couple of hundred pages on that as well if you wanted to.
I love Paul's guitar solo, which is very much like the solo he did in Taxman, which is that almost sort of Indian style playing.
That's it. And again, how they influence each other, how George influenced them so much. Yeah. You know, and what I love about all these records is it's never who you think. I always used to think, all the guitars on a Beatles record are George, apart from the rhythm, and that's John. And it just was never like that, was it?
No.
Like, and so on that track, that beautiful, almost raggery guitar at the end is Paul, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, fucking hell, mate. What can you not do? You know, it's like George. No wonder George. No wonder they all wanted to get away from him, because it's like, oh, Ringo's not turned up, so I'll play the drums better than Ringo. You know, George isn't here. He's with Patty, so I'll play the guitar better than George would have done it. Not to say that that's not diminishing them. And the other thing you realise after the fact is that Paul, for all that, there was loads of stuff that Paul was lacking that the others, especially John, gave in spades. And so that was... But Paul was the workhorse, wasn't he? It was like, Paul will do it. You know, he can just do a bit of everything. You know, he's a jack of all trades. It's ridiculous what he can do.
Yeah.
And my eldest pointed out to me the other day, because kids are all about numbers, aren't they now? They're all about, how many streams have you got? How many downloads? How many monthly listens? I'm like, I don't give a fuck, mate. How many monthly listens do you think Queen's got, Dad? I don't care. Yeah, but you should. I don't. But he was like, something is the Beatles' most streamed song. So it's like George Forever, the little brother, George Forever, the last one to join or whatever, George Forever, the junior partner.
Yeah.
He's still the one who gets, you know, that Frank Sinatra, that classic dick, isn't it? The best Lennon and McCartney song ever written, something.
Yeah.
But, you know, George influencing the others and Paul's guitar playing and everything. It's so beautiful, really.
Yeah.
I've hardly mentioned Ringo at all, which I feel bad about, because he's... I bet Matt went on about Ringo a lot in his podcast, though.
He did, yeah. There's a lot of love.
Brilliant.
One, two, three, four.
Penultimate song is the reprise, which is Ringo. Really, you're saying about the rock drumming, but this is pretty good, I think.
He's awesome, Ringo. And again, I'm letting you into all the different arguments we have with in the car, me and the kids. My middle one's a guitar player, and my eldest one's a drummer, and he's of that age where he can't. It's against his religion to agree with his dad about anything. So anything he knows that I like, he hates.
Yeah.
And we'll listen to some Beatles sometimes, and he'll go, not any good Ringo, though, is he? I'll be like, because he knows what's, you know, he knows.
He's just being difficult.
You have got no idea what you're talking. I'm pulling the car over now. You've got no idea what you're, and I'll tell you why. And he's just smirking, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's it. It's all old news, isn't it? But the sound that George Martin gets out the drums, out the Ludwigs, is ridiculous anyway. I've never heard... People emulate it, but it's not the same, is it? You know, Jeff Lynne can emulate it forever, but he knows he's never going to get it, because there's something about... I don't know what it is. It's just ineffable and magical and religious, really. But... We know about the fact that he's left-handed, but he plays right-handed, so he leads with his left or something, so it makes everything a bit more lollopy.
Mm.
Let Matt talk about that ad nauseum. But the way that the drums are tuned, it's just... But yeah, that reprise is a bit of... It's just a lazily... Again, the Beatles lazily sort of... semi-creating another genre in it. You know, they're almost going, well, it's probably punk's going to sound a bit like this in about 10 years. But we will be gone by then. We don't give a shit. We'll be gone by then. You know, you do what you want with it.
Yeah.
But the Stooges,
yeah,
this kind of thing was really happening. But they used to just nail things and then move on, didn't they?
Absolutely.
But apart from that, there's not much to say about it, is there? It's just, apart from that, It was Neil Aspinall, wasn't it, who suggested they do a bookend, you know?
Yeah.
And then the band come back.
Yeah.
Which is lovely. It's a lovely little idea. And it leads us into one of the greatest pieces of music of all time.
Final track on the album, A Day in the Life.
Rubbish. Absolute rubbish. It just... We did this, me and my mate Kev, right? We he's an absolute obsessive about music, Kev. But about 20 years ago, we went traveling. You know, we went to New Zealand and stuff, and then we went to the Grand Canyon once together, and we got there, and it was, as you know, look, one day we were there, and it was, we were there for sunset, and just before sunset, this a couple of massive coaches turn up, and a lot of tourists pile out, and they all get the cameras out, waiting for the sunset. And me and Kev we just went rubbish and walked off to the bar, you know, it, just as a joke. I mean, obviously it's not rubbish, but it was, we thought that was hilarious, you know, like that somebody should do a sketch about that, yeah, about just turning up to the most beautiful places and then saying the crap. But but that's a bit like this song, isn't it? It's almost like I've noticed that with people, sometimes when emotions are too big, your brain switches off and you go into silent mode. And obviously this is one of those things, isn't it? It's like trying to describe love or something. It's like, well, how are you going to do that? Where do you start with A Day in the Life? I mean, what have other people said about it? Religious experience?
It's along those lines, yeah. It's so big a song. It's just breaking every rule there is, and it had such simple origins as John, again, on his own, strumbling away on his guitar. He did do a version in Kenwood with different lyrics called, unfortunately, Hold On, I'm Coming.
It's like, fuck, he changed that.
But again, it was just this simple acoustic melody. The same thing with Strawberry Fields, two acoustic songs that bring, oh, I'll play that to the lads, see what happens. And then that happens.
Yeah. Well, I mean, where it comes from is fascinating, isn't it? Because like you said before, we know that a lot of this era of John, well, actually all eras of John, funnily enough, for the record, I'm holding up a bedside book here, John Lennon, 1980, which I'm sort of stumbling through lazily at nighttime sometimes as a ancillary book. But that's the interesting thing about it is that it shows you that he never changed, really. He was never happier than when he was in a big room on his own, just surrounded by magazines and papers and books and shit like that, maybe a guitar. And that's what this sprung out of as well, wasn't it? That very famous, was it one of the, who was it? Tara Guinness, was it, or somebody, yeah, the chap who died? Because he was in their circle, wasn't he? He was one of their mates, I think. Paul knew him, didn't he?
Yeah.
The guy who actually did die in the car crash.
Yeah. Again, John reading the paper.
I mean, just as well it wasn't the Daily Mail now, you know. Imagine that. Imagine what songs would have been like then. It would have been a lot darker and more horrible.
Oh.
But
imagine.
Some Brexit anthem.
Yeah.
It would have been.
Imagine there's no immigrants.
That would be it if it was the Daily Mail. But yeah, it's just so almost childlike, really. And his vocal is so innocent and light. It, at the time, you know, as an absolute contrast to what else was going on around that time, you know, the sort of, somebody like Joe Cocker or somebody, or an Otis Redding even, giving it a real sort of manly grunt, or a bit later on, the rock guys, you know, you sort of Plants and like that, the sort of testosterone-fueled madness. This, when you listen to this song, that's what it makes me realise, is how right you are to say that this is John. We've almost lost him at this point, haven't we? He's so high, he's so off the planet because he's trying to escape the planet because it represents pain for him, probably. You know, he's got a broken relationship. He doesn't see his kid. He's the most famous guy in the world, but he doesn't want to be. He's breaking his brain. So he's breaking his own brain. He's taking loads of acid. He's going off the planet. And this is like almost like ground control to Major Tom, isn't it? This is his sort of message back to Earth. And that voice just moves me because it's just so fragile in a way. and quiet, and it's absolutely beautiful, really. And then it just unfolds, doesn't it, into this. Somebody's kicked the back door of George Martin's imagination open, and they've all crawled through. It's almost like a big, like the back of an Oxfam shop or something, with loads of instruments in it, loads of costumes and loads of props, and they off they go into the wilderness. They just create something unbelievably epic, really. And the whole orchestra playing on one note, ascending up to a climax. I mean, that, there's only swear words remain, don't they?
It's
insert
like,
swear word.
It's like Tolkien in a song.
And then Paul just drops in his funny little bit, which is just what it needs as well. Just a little bit of lightness before. It sounds like death, doesn't it? It sounds literally like, oh, is this what happens when you die? The long chord. The end of the album, the end of the world, the death, the heat death of the universe, the end of your life, you know. It's all there. It almost feels like you've got a million video editors waiting to line that up for the bit of the documentary when John gets shot, you know. Ging-gong. And that's what it is. They've nailed it. They've nailed human experience and death in the course of 4 minutes or whatever it is.
You've just made me think of this album as the oral equivalent of Douglas Adams' Restaurant at the End of the Universe. It's basically that. Welcome, everybody.
It is. It's just unbelievably mind-blowing. And then you see the bits of video of when they're recording that orchestral bit, and everybody's there, aren't they? Like, Mick, all the Stones are there, and
Keith particularly looks off his tits, doesn't he?
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, what do we do? You know, in the toilet. Brilliant. I mean, it's just beautiful.
You've interviewed Paul, haven't you? I've heard a story about this.
I interviewed him a couple of times, and well, but it's always very perfunctory. Matt, my compatriot in crime, has talked to Paul a lot. He's had some really good chats with him.
Yeah,
I've less so me, but a couple of funny things happened. Like once, I did it for Radio 2 in 2008, and I only got 8 minutes with him, and it was a bit crap because, you know, he was just giving me the sort of rote answers, really, and I didn't get a chance to get in there.
Yeah,
but interesting things happened. He signed a ukulele for me, which I then absent-mindedly, because it was around the time of Children in Need, I thought I'll tell you what, I'll send it upstairs and let them auction it, you know, because it might make a few hundred quid. That 14 grand.
Wow, that's amazing.
So that thanks for that, Paul. But the other funny thing about that chat was when we listened back to it, I was so nervous that I said, yeah. I said, yeah, about, I think they counted it like 2 times. So I got my producer to edit all the years out and put them all together, my years.
Yeah.
And then at the end, of course, we finished with, yeah. And that was a funny little radio piece. And then the only other time it was exciting was many years later, he did a session for Six Music in Maida Vale, and Lauren Laverne was like interviewing him, and it was dead nice. I got to ask him a question about his bass or something, and then everybody went in. There's a sort of little ante room next to the Bing Crosby studio, and everybody gathers in there after the event. And I was in there next to his kids. I think James was there, and Heather was there, and Heather was saying to me, I don't know why. He always insists on playing Oh Bloody Oh Bloody Oh. I just hate it. I was like, I don't know why he played that one. And I always tell the story. There was a water fountain next to me, so I just got a cup of water and just handed it over to him. I said, do you want a drink, Paul? Thanks very much. So I rehydrated a beetle.
Superb. So
that's my sort of on the tombstone story, really.
You've given it, McCartney 3 may not have happened without you.
Oh, he could have keeled over at that point. I interviewed Ringo and Paul in Abbey Road.
Wow.
But it was one of the most horrible experiences of our life. Me and my producer, we sat in the main room in Abbey Road. So we did it for that experience alone, really, just to be in there with them. And we got less than 8 minutes. We got like six and a half minutes all the time. Mm. There was a woman in my peripheral vision just going,
like,
speed it up, finish. Really? So it was a really unpleasant experience, but it was worth doing just to see them in there. And this is where you end up treating them like deities, and it's awful, and they're just people. But they were both absolutely lovely, and they were very gracious under intense pressure, you know, which again makes you think how anybody can come out the other side of that and not be like Donald Trump, not like be an absolute monster, is it must mean that you're good people, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
That's the way I feel about them. I just think they're good people.
Sean Keaveney, it's been a joy. Overall, this album, which didn't mean much to you before, what does it mean to you now?
It means the world to me. I absolutely love it. And I play it to my kids. I play it to my littlest baby. She doesn't know if she likes it or not yet. The jury's out. I just think it's just so full of everything that's the best thing about the Beatles, the ideas, the collaboration, the sounds, the heart and the soul, you know, it's beautiful. And I'm going to go and hang up on this call and go and listen to it now.
Same here. Sean Keaveney, thanks very much.
Thank you. That was really a pleasure.